I'd like to welcome you all to this Friends of the University of Adelaide Library Discovery event. I'd like to particularly welcome today the patron of the Friends, Christopher Legault. Some of you may be aware, or you may not, that he is a great-grandson of our founding benefactor, Robert Barr Smith, and a grandson of Tom Barr Smith, who, of course, provided the donation or the funds to build the great Barr Smith Library Reading Room. I'm also very pleased to welcome the University Librarian, Teresa Chitty. Having had some experience of the demands of the University Librarian's calendar, thank you for joining us, Teresa. I'm Paul Wilkins, the Secretary of the Friends. Just quickly, what this idea of a discovery event is about. The idea of these discovery events is really to showcase resources which have supported research and to give you a chance to discover what some of those resources are. And we've got a splendid display here today from rare books and special collections to showcase material that supported the research of our speakers today, who have produced this marvellous book, The Art of Science, Nicholas Bodin's Voyages, 1800 to 1804. Some of you would have seen the exhibition that surrounded this work at the Maritime Museum, and that exhibition is continuing, I believe, and is now down in Tassie. So to come to the authors, there are three authors I'll introduce, and then they will address you and explain how they're going to proceed. So, first of all, Jean Fornasario. Jean is Emeritus Professor of French Studies here at the University of Adelaide. Lyndall Lawton, we're very pleased, is joining us. She's our second author, and Lyndall is a Senior Curator at the South Australian Maritime Museum, which many of you, of course, will be familiar with, and where, of course, the exhibition I mentioned, which many of you would have seen, was staged. And then third author, John West Subi, who is a professor of French studies here at the University of Adelaide. So I think that's all I need to say at this stage, and we'll move into the presentations. So I think we're starting with John.
Yeah. Okay, I should begin by thanking Paul and the Friends for hosting us here today and all of you for coming. We hope that you'll enjoy the presentation. One of the nice things about talking about the Bodin expedition is there are lots of nice images to show to go with the words. I should also thank Cheryl Hosking from Special Collections for preparing this display. If you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, you'll see prominent on these tables over here is the first edition of the official account of the voyage, published the first volume in 1807 and through to 1816, open at different pages. And I'll draw your attention in particular to the middle one on this side, which has an autograph. And if you look closely, it looks very much like it belonged to the son of the great Bougainville. So how it found its way into the library's collection is a story we've tried to tell in an article at some point. We think that he was preparing his own voyage to the Pacific after some 15 or so years after travelling here with Bodin. He went back to that volume on navigation and geography to refresh his memory, and he's made certain annotations in the margins, which are quite interesting. I'm going to start by taking you back to the year 2000 and to the Natural History Museum in Le Havre in Normandy. That year marked the end of an era. It marked the period when the director of the museum, the long-standing director, retired, and also the curator of the Le Sueur collection, which is where all of these drawings from the voyage to Australia by Nicolas Bodin were kept, also retired. Two new people took over those roles, Cédric Crémière as the director and Gabriel Baglione as the curator of the Le Sueur collection. And they had a vision. They wanted to modernise the collection and promote it more widely. And they also felt that it would be a useful instrument for their institution to start to forge relationships with other institutions in Australia, but also elsewhere in the world. And so they began an ambitious project of restoration of the drawings, which had laid untouched pretty much for 200 years, and digitising them, making digital photographs of them, creating a website to put all this material online. And once that process was well underway, they then started scouting for opportunities to promote the collection. Cédric Crémière, over the course of two or three visits to Australia, running from about 2013 to 2015, started talking to institutions in Australia about the idea of doing an exhibition featuring these illustrations from the Bourdin Voyage. He got a lot of interest. Various institutions were very interested in taking on this idea, but no one would jump in the water and say, yes, we'll do it, until he came to speak to our friends at the Maritime Museum, and that was the domino that needed to fall for the other institutions to take the plunge. And it's at this point that I'll hand over then to Lyndall Lawton, who will tell you the story of how that exhibition came together, and then we'll take up the story of the book afterward.
So, I'm going to talk about the exhibition. It is touring, as mentioned, so if you didn't see it at the South Australian Maritime Museum, it's in Tassie at the moment, then goes to Sydney, Canberra and Western Australia. It showcases a different suite of paintings at each venue. So if you've seen it at one venue, you can see it at another. So I'm going to give you a bit of background on developing the exhibition, how we put it together with a host of other Australian institutions, and my lovely little research trip to France, first one ever. So you get to see my holiday snaps, which are relevant. Okay. So this is what I've called my talk, Desperately Seeking Bourdin. And this is a terrible photo to begin with, but it is relevant. So I want you to look at this cluster of chronometers or historic marine timepieces at the National Maritime Museum in Paris. Bourdin's chronometer was once displayed in that empty space. His valuable timepiece was used to highlight the evolution of this instrument and influence of its maker, Berthoud. There was no mention in the label at all of its owner. What I discovered while researching our exhibition, The Art of Science, is that Nicolas Bourdin, who returned to France with one of the most impressive scientific hauls in European history, is a relative non-entity in the country of his birth. Most Australians do know of him and his expedition he commanded on the ships Geographe and Naturaliste to the southern lands in 1800. The exquisite drawings and paintings, one of my favourite, made by his artists Charles-Alexandre Le Sueur and Nicolas Martin Petit on the ships and on camps on the shore, are the very first European glimpses of our southern coastline and its wildlife. Yet while these were the scientific snapshots of the day, they also betray the sense of utter wonder and delight the artist and naturalist experienced at the bizarre topsy-turvy world on the underside of the globe. Another favourite. Their lush watercolours of diaphanous, often bioluminescent marine invertebrates and shimmering silver-scaled fish seem almost as fresh as the day they were painted 200 years ago. Bourdin's voyages had no direct encounters with Aboriginal people on our southern coast, but his was the first European expedition with an explicit anthropological agenda. Armed with instructions from the fledgling Society for the Observers of Man, Bourdin's artists created intimate and highly accurate portraits of Aboriginal people in other parts of the continent, inscribed, very unusually for the time, with their names. So why have the French forgotten Bourdin? Some ideas. In the galleries of the French Maritime Museum, where number 31 chronometer is displayed, the voyages of the French explorers who preceded and followed Bourdin are celebrated. There are artefacts linked to La Perouse, who, after weighing anchor at Botany Bay in 1788, famously sailed away and vanished in the Pacific. D'Entrecasteaux, who was instructed to go in search for him. And the voyages of France's answer to Captain Cook, Jules-Sébastien de Montdeville. But there is nothing on Bourdin. Bourdin was a well-respected scientific voyager prior to his 1800 expedition. In 1796, he led a highly celebrated scientific voyage to the Caribbean on the Belle Angélique. The directors of the fledgling National Museum of Natural History in Paris had encouraged Napoleon to place him in charge of another voyage. But Bourdin lost control of the expedition planning. When he left Le Havre in October, he was lumbered with an unwieldy contingent of 22 scientists, at least three times more than he actually wanted, and over 200 crew. When the ships finally arrived at Île-de-France, Mauritius, after a tediously long passage, half his scientists and all three of his official artists abandoned ship. Those that left the expedition were keen to salvage their reputations. They wrote official letters and accounts criticising the captain, tainting Baudin's reputation and impugning that of the voyage as a whole. And it was a difficult voyage. The two vessels sailed at different paces and constantly missed their scheduled rendezvous. A cautious navigator, Baudin was unwilling to make too many landfalls, and scurvy ravaged the crew. Tensions escalated between the officers of noble birth and citizen Baudin, and Officer Blue of modest origins. There was constant friction between the agendas of surveying and collecting. Baudin clashed with François Perron, the meticulous but obsessive naturalist who rose through the ranks after the other scientists jumped ship. And it was Perron who wrote the official account after Baudin died of tuberculosis on the return voyage. Baudin had no chance to defend his reputation, and Perron effectively wrote his commander out of history, mentioning his name once in the two-volume account of the voyage, which you'll see on display. That was the day he died. Geographer and naturalist returned to France, listing from the weight of well in excess of 100,000 specimens, the decks below crowded with the pens of 72 live animals. While the museum directors were ecstatic, Napoleon had moved on, his focus elsewhere. It took 2 years for Perron to secure funding for the official account. 200 ethnographic artefacts collected in Tasmania and Port Jackson simply vanished. Specimens in the museum were stored but not systematically catalogued. Artist Petit died soon after he returned to Le Havre, and Le Sieur left for the USA, miffed at his shabby treatment by the government. There's the handsome Le Sieur. He held on to the folio of drawings made on the voyage rather than lodging them with the Paris Museum, eventually donating them to the museum in his hometown, Le Havre. That this archive of over 1,500 artworks survives at all is a minor miracle. Le Havre was occupied by German forces during World War II, and the Allies virtually obliterated the city in September 1944. Le Havre's Museum of Natural History was flattened and most of the collections incinerated. In fact, they're still restoring some of the objects from that particular blast. The curator of the Le Sieur collection had the foresight, however, to shift the flammable paper material to a more secure location. So how did this exhibition come about? It is this museum alone in France that seems to truly understand Baudin's significance to both French and Australian history. Our museum was familiar with some of the works from our 2012 exhibition, Terre Napoléon, showcasing the 40 or so engravings published with the official account. At the end of 2014, as John mentioned, we were approached by director Cédric Premier, who asked if Sam would like to exhibit the originals. We were, in a word, gobsmacked. Usually we have to plead to borrow works of such monumental importance. From there, the project snowballed. Once Sam had signed on, other national institutions also wanted in. Six national institutions in total collaborated on the development of the art of science. This, I might add, was also a first in the Australian museum world. We often share exhibitions, we don't collaborate. Logistically, it was fraught. But for a small institution such as our own, this model of collaboration was the only way in which we could have ever hoped to bring this material over. National institutions such as the National Museum of Australia and the Australian National Maritime Museum could apply for substantial grants, such as NACETO, so National Collections and Touring and Outreach, pitched directly at bringing out international collections significant to Australian audiences. Negotiating the truly nightmarish logistics of international loans was something that registrars at NMA were highly skilled at, and they assumed the role of international loans manager for the entire project. And remember, we will eventually bring out over 350 artworks. In turn, the larger institutions were sceptical that an exhibition could be developed and built within the very ambitious timeframe of 12 months and our modest development budget of around $100,000. Thinking laterally, working nimbly, and stretching modest budgets for maximum impact was the norm for us. The SA Maritime Museum demonstrated to its better resource partners that small museums have much to offer in terms of delivering projects imaginatively, promptly, and economically. And if you haven't seen the exhibition at the Maritime Museum, there's a picture. Looking for Le Sieur. One of the silver linings to my role as curator on the project was a research trip to France funded by the French government. I arrived in Paris late one evening and spent a couple of days recovering from jet lag before making the short train journey to Le Havre in Normandy, where I spent a week poring over paintings, sketches and manuscripts held on site and finalising the selections for each of the touring venues. On the last days, curator Gabriel Baglion took me on a sightseeing tour of the district looking for Lesueur. We visited the red fossil-encrusted cliffs nearby that he often painted on his return from the United States and squinted through the wrought iron gates at his last home in the town of Saint-Andrés. By strange coincidence, Lesueur's descendants recently moved into a house nearby, not realising that their famous relative had lived so close. They knew Lesueur was a painter voyager, but had absolutely no inkling of his significance, believing the family whispers to be hollow boasts. These French relatives discovered both Lesueur and Baudin through the museum. Le Havre is famous for its still grey skies. It was an unusually summery September day when we went looking for Lesueur. As I gazed out from the cliffs, I could almost conjure up that day, 215 years ago, when Baudin's ships, their sails billowing, headed out into the big blue. Back in Paris, I began desperately seeking evidence of Baudin amongst its museums and archives. Once the expedition reached Mauritius on the return voyage, all naval officers were instructed to hand in their journals, sea logs and charts. The expedition had come to its official end, and these documents were sealed in a trunk under lock and key, the official property of the French government. Back in France, the trunk's contents were deposited at the National Archives. The National Archives in the Marais district of Paris was established in the 1790s and from 1808 located here. Much of the collection is stored in bunkers underneath the building, accessed by a vast labyrinth of twisting tunnels and stairwells. Its collection linked to Baudin's voyage is extraordinarily rich, although most of it has never come up from storage. I spent a day with archivist Bridget Smalsch chasing Baudin's paper trail. And I've got to say, it was one of the most enjoyable days of my life. We very carefully turned the pages of his handwritten sea log that South Australian Christine Cornell had first translated into English in 1974. This is not that one, this is the fair copy. And the perfect copperplate script of the fair or show copy of his sea journal, the tome he had recruited young artist Lesueur and Petit to illustrate. That's one of the pages we had it open on in our exhibition. Most of the drawings had been cut out from the two volumes. I had seen many of them in Le Havre the week before. They're identifiable by the navigational coordinates where the specimen was plucked from the sea. It's a little sunfish. But a smattering of images remained, profiles of the low-slung Western Australian coast, their pastel blues and greens as vivid as the day they had been painted into the journal. This fair copy was first brought to light by Le Havre's curator Jacqueline Bonneman, who transcribed it and published it in French. It has never been translated into English, and until it came to South Australia, it had never been displayed before. A wonderful discovery was 200 highly detailed coastal profiles. These were detailed images of the shoreline painted from the ship as navigational aids. These seem to be the official coastal profiles painted by Lesueur, Petit, or perhaps both, and cover the voyage. The rich pink granite and feldspar outcrops of the Freycinet Peninsula in Tasmania, the undulating dunes of the Coorong and Ravine de Casores on Kangaroo Island. They capture wheeling flocks of gulls, gum trees and blue-grey plumes of smoke, suggesting that the voyagers were being observed. We borrowed two for the exhibition. The date at the top of this one is the 8th of April, 1802. Anyone knows what happened then? Quiz? Yes, the encounter. It was painted on the morning of the day Baudin encountered Flinders off the southern coast and learned that the English had beaten him to the greater part of the unknown coast. Smoke billows from part of the shoreline. The Narrangiri were watching. The profiles also hint at how Baudin was gradually hidden from history through the documents. Baudin selected place names that reflected the shape of the land, the dramas of the voyage, and honoured his expeditioners. Many of his names have been crossed out on the profiles and replaced with others. Perron and Freycinet deleted Baudin's names and substituted them with others designed to curry favour with the powerful and influential. Named Carter by the Narangiri, Flinders Kangaroo Island was renamed Île Borde by Baudin, and in France became Île de Grès after the powerful minister of the marine. Baudin's innocuously named southwest coast became Terre Napoléon. Sheaves of hand-drawn maps in other folios revealed a similar story. Kangaroo Island was first mapped by Flinders, but circumnavigated and surveyed in detail by the French when Baudin returned with the shallow drafted Casuarina in 1803. These are the first European maps of the island, and there are delightful links between Baudin's journal and these works, detailing the time they were created, their makers, and the litany of dramas involved in the surveying work. Madame Josephine is also pivotal to Baudin's story. Her representatives tussled at the docks with those from the Paris Museum for the expedition's scientific hall. Napoleon penned abrupt letters to its directors, who officially owned all the expedition's spoil, ordering them to indulge Madame Bonaparte and share the menagerie of black swans, dwarf emus and western grey kangaroos from Kangaroo Island, and the packets of seeds and tubs of seedlings to cultivate in her nursery. Most of Baudin's botanists and gardeners perished from disease, and ill health forced key botanist Lechenard de la Tour to abandon the voyage before it returned to France. Artist Lesueur received instructions from Perron, whose interests lay mainly in animals. The world glimpsed the expedition's botanical bounty through the lavish garden at Malmaison. Josephine commissioned botanical artist Pierre-Joseph Redite to paint the plants grown from specimens brought back by the expedition, published as coloured plates in the rare books The Garden at Malmaison and a description of rare plants cultivated at Malmaison and Navarre. She sent Australian seedlings throughout France. Many of the gum trees and acacias on the Mediterranean coastline are probably linked to Baudin's voyage. Like other collectors of the era, Josephine hankered for the prestige attached to owning exotic specimens, but she also had a serious scientific interest and an acute and inquiring mind. Malmaison is now a short train ride through the suburbs of western Paris. The sprawling estate was ruthlessly subdivided during the 19th century. The great greenhouse, warmed by 12 coal-fired stoves and a smaller cluster of buildings, Petite Malmaison, was sold off from the main estate. This is where Josephine kept her kangaroos and emus and is now privately owned. But at Malmaison proper, there is scarcely a hint of Baudin and Josephine's scientific collecting. Her famous rose gardens are being revived, and the meandering informal English garden where other animals grazed is much in evidence. Inside it is mainly a homage to the great but turbulent romance between Josephine and Napoleon, and the decorative arts inspired by the couple. There are tantalising hints in those decorative arts of Baudin's bounty, wooden inlays of black swans in the furniture and sinuous swan-handled vases. Napoleon famously took pot shots at them from his window, but he was a notoriously bad shot. I had a brief conversation with an attendant in the small shop at the entrance. He confirmed that Malmaison has quite a lot of Australian visitors and mostly a tad disappointed. As I'm about to leave, I glimpse a banksia and acacia, cultivated in pots in the nursery. Perhaps changes in the wind. Our director at the moment of the Maritime Museum has just visited Malmaison, and he sent me back some lovely photos of black swans. So they've been installed, and there is some interpretation regarding those specimens in particular. Although the kangaroos no longer graze in Malmaison's lawns, they do roam the botanical gardens in the grounds of Paris's Museum of Natural History. Despite the ongoing war between France and England, Sir Joseph Banks, a great believer in the Commonwealth of Learning, gave the museum its first pair of kangaroos in 1802, joined soon after by live specimens collected from Kangaroo Island. Hundreds of thousands of specimens were deposited at the museum, increasing its holdings several fold. Its directors were thrilled by the riches brought back by Baudin. Georges Cuvier suggesting that Perron and Lesueur have discovered more new animals than all the travelling naturalists of modern days. The specimens, shells that have been buried in buckets of sand to kill the mollusks, hundreds of bird skins rubbed with arsenical soap, jellyfish and fish adrift in flasks of white rum, minerals, insects and butterflies impaled on boards of cork, and a vast herbarium of dried and pressed plants were accompanied by Perron's meticulous notes detailing source and habitats. Perron published a smattering of papers on marine invertebrates, but died in 1810 before he could publish the bulk of his zoological findings. Botanist Lechenal made it back to France much later and never studied the collection in great detail, preferring to continue his botanical globetrotting. Over the decades, the collection was separated from notes when displayed, and its value gradually eroded. Without systematic cataloguing, Bodin's bounty slowly faded from view. But the collection is still there, bottled, dried, pickled, and stuffed. The specimens have stood the test of time remarkably well in storage. And the Paris Museum, and it breaks my heart to say this, did agree to loan several sets of specimens to each Australian institution for the tour. These included a dingo, possums, phascogales, taxidermied fish and sea stars that had been scooped from the sands of the southern coast. There's our dingoes. Possum looking rather melancholy, it's lost its tail. I love this one. It looks out of something out of an animation. Original label. So, unfortunately, the notoriously lumbering bureaucracy of these big institutions, where even Le Havre has failed to secure loan specimens, meant that ultimately the costs exceeded our budget and the times required for permissions from the multi-layered levels of curators and collection managers were simply too long. To illustrate how impenetrable this institution can sometimes be, we can cite the example of Belgian scientist and historian Michel Jangot. He knew Bodin's herbarium must still exist in the museum, but he was rebuffed, I think, at least three times when he offered to search. On about the fourth request, he was permitted into the archives and discovered Bodin's rich botanical collection, hidden under the noses of the museum's curators, catalogued under everything but Bodin's name. He has since thoroughly documented the collection, which includes the first botanical specimens collected by Europeans along our southern coast and 600 new species of plants. The dwarf emu skeleton, and there's still some debate, I think, whether it was taken from Kangaroo or King Island, is one of the few specimens that has made it from storage into the showcase. Both emus were extinct by 1827. In 2012, DNA was taken from this 200-year-old specimen, and scientists discovered that the dwarf emu was not, in fact, a separate species at all. So these 200-year-old specimens are not only objects of wonder, tangible evidence of one of the 19th century's greatest scientific expeditions, but have the potential to continue to inform our current understandings of species and their distribution in Australia. Finally, back to the Maritime Museum, the site of our ownerless chronometer. Locating the chronometer was somewhat of a collaborative effort between myself, French author and historian Patrick Llewellyn, and researcher Alizée Chasse. This French duo have become somewhat obsessed with Bodin and almost evangelical about bringing this story to a French audience. They have written several books, including a historic novel, developed a Bodin interactive game, and are working on a documentary project with noted French long-distance sailor Loïc Piron. While Marjolaine Mouret, the Maritime Museum's curator, was sure of the provenance of the chronometer, she did not know exactly what else they held in relation to Bodin. Glimpsing an engraved copper plate of a kangaroo used to print images for the accounts of explorer de Montdeville, I asked Marjolaine whether they had any plates linked to Perron's account. She believed they had, but wasn't sure they'd been catalogued or photographed. Through this conversation, we eventually sourced the copper plate used to print the first complete map of Australia ever published. The object was borrowed for the exhibition that, under a raking light, reveals an outline of the continent in reverse, is incredibly significant. Flinders got there first, but was famously kept under house arrest on Mauritius for 7.5 years. The French published their maps in 1811 and cheekily ignored Flinders' names. Our coast on this map is Terre Napoleon, Napoleon's land, and St. Vincent, Gulf St. Vincent and Spencer's Gulf, Gulf Josephine and Gulf Bonaparte. So in conclusion, Australians have some awareness of the voyage of Nicolas Bodin. The art of science has helped raise that awareness, but long term it may also shift the mindset of the French institutions where he has largely been ignored. I doubt if chronometer number 31 will be returned to its display case without some mention of its owner, the much neglected Nicolas Bodin. Thank you.
Now for the story of the book. I'm going to talk about the how the book project came about and some of the features of it, and then Jean will talk about some of the stories, the scientific stories that we've tried to highlight in the book. So going from the exhibition to the book became a kind of no-brainer in a sense, because as we mentioned earlier, as you've seen, there are so many beautiful images, it seemed a shame to let the exhibition happen without it leaving a material trace in the form of a book. And so it was decided that we would have a book. But of course there were a certain number of parameters within which we had to work. Now, the first was our own objective as authors and editors. We really wanted, if there's going to be another book on the Bourdain expedition, we wanted to present some new perspectives and not just rehearse the same sorts of stories. Because there had been some previous exhibitions that had led to catalogues. There was one in Sydney, at the Sydney Museum, and in 1999, and our very own art gallery here commemorated the bicentenary of the meeting of Flinders and Bourdain in 2002 with an exhibition that featured some of the drawings as well. These were very, compared to what we're currently seeing, modest collections of illustrations, but they did produce lovely catalogues, and we wanted to add to that kind of emerging tradition, if you like, but to do something a bit different. And so that was our own objective. And the art and science kind of connection pointed us, which was the ended up becoming the title for the exhibition after lengthy negotiations between the six institutions, for which I was a fly on the wall at one point. That was very interesting. Then gave us the spur to look at that this expedition and its iconography from that perspective. We found a wonderful publisher in Wakefield Press, and here's my opportunity to promote the book itself, which is on sale over here at a very modest price. Make a lovely gift for somebody. Yourself, perhaps. And Wakefield Press was adamant that they wanted to make a book that was not just a catalogue to an exhibition, but that was a proper book, so to speak, that would last, that would have a life beyond the exhibition, in fact. And so that was a kind of happy meeting of minds, in a sense. Well, there was another third working parameter, and that is that all of the participating institutions, and you see them here, our own South Australian Maritime Museum, which pioneered and organised, curated the exhibition, the Queen Victoria Museum and Art Gallery in Launceston, the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery in Hobart, the National Museum, Maritime Museum in Sydney, and the National Museum of Australia. Of course, all of those institutions wanted to be involved, and they had all sorts of ideas for what should go in this book. And so it was a little bit like when you've left a bush grow for several years and you can see that it has no shape anymore. And so that's where we got to work, and thanks to our conversations with Lyndall, we eventually pinned them all down to something that we thought was manageable. They all wanted to do all sorts of things, and so we had to try to bring them back to a certain number of themes that to avoid overlaps and to make sure that we covered the sorts of areas that we wanted to cover. So that was an interesting exercise in negotiation, shall I say. What we ended up with was talking to the National Museum of Australia, giving them the assignment of talking about the geopolitics of the expedition. They were interested in that in any case. That sort of broader context of Franco-British rivalry in the 18th century, in the Pacific in particular. And that we thought would be a useful way of contextualising the expedition. You have here the image of King Louis XVI giving his instructions to La Pérouse. So this was France really sort of saying, OK, James Cook has pioneered exploration of the Pacific. We need to get our oar in the water, so to speak. The National Maritime Museum in Sydney, they're particularly interested in more local politics, because the Bourdain expedition spent 5 months in Sydney. And there were many interactions, as you can imagine, between the French officers and sailors and their British hosts, and they were interested in this theme. They also thought that the notion of the fact that this expedition had been sponsored by Napoleon Bonaparte might be a kind of a good promotional tool, because people are interested in Napoleon, and so that was their kind of theme, if you like. In Tasmania, the Launceston Museum, QVMag, they were particularly interested in the zoology and in using the iconography from that period, from 1802-1803, as a kind of benchmark against which to measure the situation of various animals today. So they had a kind of then and now perspective, which we thought was quite quite a useful approach. The people in Hobart at the TMAG had a similar kind of approach, a then and now, but looking more properly at the anthropological dimension, because Baudin and his men spent quite a bit of time in southeast Tasmania, and they recorded a lot of Aboriginal customs and drew lots of objects. Here we, by default I guess, but also partly because mapping the previously unknown south coast was a major achievement of the exhibition, we ended up doing the cartography, the mapping and the naming, and we were quite happy actually in the end to do that because there's some good stories to tell, as Lyndall's alluded to, especially with the Terre Napoleon controversy. That's an image of Denial Bay near Ceduna with St. Peter and St. Francis Islands, the Knights Archipelago. And then the Western Australian Museum in Perth, they wanted to write about everything. And so in the end, we thought, well, okay, how do we give them a mission, an assignment? And in a sense, it sort of happened quite naturally in the end. Because that was the first landfall for the Baudin expedition, and they spent a lot of time exploring the vast Western Australian coastline. That was where they had their first encounter with Australia's Aborigines. That was when they had their first encounter with the animals, with the flora. And so we gave them the notion of first encounters as a way of allowing them to cover various points. That was quite a colourful kind of exchange we had with that mob there. And so that gave us some key chapters, which I've bolded here, to which we thought we needed to add some other information and some other essays. So we thought it would be important for people who didn't know the expedition particularly well to have a timeline, where they went and when. Our friends in Le Havre at the museum were really keen to write a chapter about their collection and some of the to give some guidelines for reading the works, if you like, so that was their essay. We felt that there needed to be, again, for people who were not familiar with with the story of the expedition, some kind of account of what they did and when, but also linking it back to what was going on in France at the time. This was the period of the French Revolution, after all. So that's Jean Fournassiero and I did an essay there. And then I was very keen to have an art historian look at some of the drawings and do a kind of proper kind of art historian's reading of some of these things. I contacted someone called Sasha Grishin, who's a well-known art historian based in Canberra, who was most enthusiastic, I'd have to say. And he chose to look at the different drawings of the wombats and to show what happened at the different stages and how they changed. I won't tell you the whole story, because if you read the little chapter in the book, you'll find it most interesting, but it was great to have that perspective. And so that's, if you like, how the book came together. There was one final working parameter, and that was the preface, or the forewords. Everyone wanted to be in the book, and in particular, the sort of political or diplomatic figures. And so, naturally enough, the mayor of Le Havre, Edouard Philippe, who was now the prime minister under the new Macron government, who had been actually very supportive of his institution in Le Havre and who had come out here to sign the agreement in 2015. And so he'd been actually instrumental. It was fair enough for him to have a foreword, to talk about the town of Le Havre, do a bit of promotion. That seemed okay. Then the ambassadors wanted to get in on the act. To be fair, the Australian ambassador to France, Stephen Brady, had been extremely helpful in organising things. The French ambassador and the embassy here in Canberra had also been helpful, funding Lyndall's trip to France, for example. And so we thought, okay, from a diplomatic point of view, we can't really avoid having all of these forewords. In the end, we didn't get one from the Australian Embassy, which is a bit of a shame. But we do have the two French ones. It was just a timing thing, and it just didn't work out. As an interesting anecdote to the French ambassador's foreword, it was written by his team, of course, who sent me the French version, which I dutifully translated. I forget which one of us did it. Sent back, and then they picked up the phone and wanted to quibble about three words that we'd translated. I thought, okay, let's talk about this. Right, we negotiated our way through it. In the end, just by pure accident, the ambassador's foreword spilled over a little bit onto the next page. And I thought, aesthetically, that's not a good look. So I talked to the people at Wakefield Press and said, I think we need to bring this back to one page. And so I did a bit of trimming here and there. So I got my revenge. Bit of pruning, yes. Well, yeah, there's a lot of pruning involved. Just to finish with, there were some hurdles, but also some happy accidents. One of the hurdles was, or the obstacle, one of the difficulties, if you like, was securing images and reproduction rights. Now, for all of the images we wanted to use from the Le Havre collection, there was no problem because they were involved, they were a partner in organising this. But there were many images we wanted to use from other sources. Some of them were relatively easy to get, some were quite difficult. And so that did take a fair bit of time, as Lyndall would attest. Another interesting quirk was that our friends in Tasmania, in the two Tasmanian institutions, for some reason had the idea that we weren't going to be allowed to use reproductions of the original drawings in the book. And so they went and took photographs of all of the things, the objects, the specimens that they wanted to talk about. So in the end, we had both the drawings and then these lovely photographs, and we spoke to the people at Wakefield Press and said, it'd be a shame not to use these as well. Would it be possible to do a juxtaposition? And that produced lovely pages like this, where you have their photograph here of a blue bottle and the original French drawing. And so serendipitously, that I think produced a very nice set of pages for the catalogue, and it also spoke to their theme, which was then and now. Another sort of parenthetical story about this particular image. You may not be an expert on blue bottles, but and I wasn't either until I started to look at this. There are actually two species, of Physalia. You have the Physalia physalis, which is better known as the Portuguese man of war, which is quite a large thing and very dangerous. And then you have, and it's found pretty much around the world. And then you have a smaller version, which is called the Physalia utriculus, and it's what we call the blue bottle. And the zoologist who wrote this kind of commentary on the drawing was referring to this as the Physalia utriculus, so it was the blue bottle. I knew that drawing was made during the passage through the Atlantic Ocean because one of the versions of it was cut out of the journal. And so it couldn't possibly be the Australian blue bottle. How do you write to a zoologist when you're not the specialist to sort of suggest diplomatically that maybe this is the other one? We managed to negotiate those waters, but it was just an example of some of the difficulties and the interesting things that come up when you're doing this. And here's some of these other pages where you've got these incredible photographs alongside the actual drawings from the time. So at this point, I'll hand over to Jean for the science.
Now, we had a multiplicity of stories, and we sought to contain these by composing and commissioning a series of vignettes that you'll find throughout the book and that complemented the big stories on scientific voyaging. I've highlighted four discipline areas that either presented significant advances brought about by the Baudin expedition data, that have more to offer in terms of future advances, for example. I'll go through the four of those one by one. Anthropology. Now, we have a scientific record here of what has been lost, but because drawings such as these are preserved through serial collections, they show that the published portrait, which is on the right, is no photograph, and it's certainly no snapshot in time. The photograph, the portrait evolved through different stages, and you'll see that on the bottom at the left, we have a very pale-skinned subject, whereas a second painter, this is top left, who was not on the exhibition at the time that these paintings were done and did not encounter those particular peoples, he had drawn the subject with a much darker skin and without any scarifications. Now, it's his view instead of the original artist's view at bottom left that has prevailed in the eventual published portrait, which appeared in the Atlas of the Voyage. The scarifications have returned, but the colour is dark, the eyes are different, and there is a different definition of the abdominal muscles. Therefore, this kind of record, which is valuable because it portrays something lost in a way, it also shows the various attitudes of the artists towards the subject. So it reveals as much about the observer or the observers as the observed. Indeed, the annotations on the portraits have become a vital source of information on how the scientists constructed their narrative, which was not therefore completely objective, nor innocent, nor divorced from their own particular attitudes. So these serial portraits are a reminder of the complexities of the visual record, but a resource that continues to allow interrogation of the scientific story it tells. Other stories can be less problematic, however. The record here shows an indigenous artifact captured by Le Sueur in a pencil sketch, top right, and reproduced by Petit in one of his Tasmanian portraits. So this is a case of preserving the memory of an artifact that remains greatly treasured by its indigenous owners. It's an iconic image, and it's become, for current day indigenous Tasmanians, a symbol of the wealth of cultural knowledge that remains intact, but also a source of inspiration for creativity in Indigenous art. When it comes to ornithology, we all know the story, I think, of the Baudin expedition emus, which took live specimens and skins back to the Paris Museum and Malmaison. This is also a story featured within the catalogue. Note, however, that this is another interesting aspect of the visual record. It's a composite image. This is quite a strong feature of Le Sueur's mode of zoological representation. It's both modern and decidedly anthropomorphic. He seemed to enjoy constructing animal families, as he did with the wombats and as he did here. Nevertheless, this remains part of a record that continues to give, as Le Sueur's family of emus has proved through DNA testing that Lindell mentioned, that the dwarf species of King Island and Kangaroo Island are related to the common emu who also features in the family and who Le Sueur has perhaps not consciously added to prove a family relationship, but the family relationship is there. Next ornithological detail. This is the mystery bird of St. Peter Island in the Nuitza Archipelago. No specimen of this bird has survived in the extensive Baudin collections, but Le Sueur's detailed drawing and the notes that you can faintly see on the side continue to interest ornithologists in view of the bird's disappearance. It does not exist on St. Peter Island. So the field was narrowed down, the field of contenders for this mystery bird nomenclature was narrowed down to two after consulting the records. A noisy scrub bird and a bristle bird, for those of you who wish to read that particular vignette. But this is an example of ornithological research that continues. The search is on for perhaps bones within the original habitat of this bird. Botany. Now, botany is not meant to feature heavily in the Baudin expedition's achievements, but this is something of a misrepresentation. It was not because this branch of science was deemed to have been neglected by French savants, neglected in comparison with the Brown collection that was fully studied by Robert Brown soon after his return to Europe. But there was an extensive botanical legacy. As we have hinted at through the images of plants that we've included in the book and that were collected on Baudin's voyages and propagated widely, as Lindell has said. Not only were they propagated, but they were studied, namely at the Paris Museum, where Baudin's herbarium was integrated into the museum's general herbarium and has been at the disposal of botanists ever since. It is now online. There is an interesting image here, if you just wish to see what that looks like, but there are hundreds of specimens that have been preserved in this way, and you can see the transcription of the original labels that provide a great deal of information as to where they came from, where they were collected, etc. You should note, if you are readers of French, that the gardener's French was absolutely appalling and that a second label had to be created in order to translate it into French. It's pretty well phonetic. So this is now an international resource for botanists whose importance continues to grow. With zoology, there are sadder stories to tell, unfortunately. Baudin's expedition preserved the record of once flourishing species, such as the spotted handfish and the Australian fur seal, which are both under threat for very different reasons. But while their circumstances differ, the information sources from the Baudin expedition remain intact. Are they any defence against the current realities introduced species or overfishing? Perhaps not. But it's to be hoped that the sensitive and delicate portraits of these animals can help to heighten public interest in their preservation. So if science in its different manifestations was the main topic of our narrative within this book, it also had to contend for its place alongside the giant footprint of Napoleon on the Baudin expedition story. So I'll just very quickly run through some of those main points. We know that Le Sueur's depiction of Sydney had strategic implications because of all of the buildings that were carefully named within his maps. We know too that Perron wrote reports back to his government in France. This is the first page of his memoir, which is dedicated to the proposition that the French should take over the colony of Port Jackson. And then there's the rather farcical skirmish on King Island, where the British were following Baudin in case he had decided to set up a colony in that vague region. And there was the hoisting of the British flag on King Island, which Baudin dismissed rather sternly by saying he thought that the flag had been hung up to dry, hung up outside, upside down to dry. There is also the Napoleonic mark on the cartography of the expedition, and this is both imperial with the eagle, but the eagle also refers to the Napoleonic period, and you'll see that in all of the major maps you will have that imperial reference, those kinds of images that were popularised during the Napoleonic reign. So it made its way into the expedition cartography and into its nomenclature, where Terre Napoléon did replace Côte Sud-Ouest. The southwest coast was the name by which this coast was known before our expeditioners proceeded there. However, to balance that up against the science, we need to remember that Napoleonic period was a moment in history, and not an extremely long one at that, and that most of its role in the expedition was retrospective, imposed on the maps after the return of the expedition. So none of the political aspects of the expedition can efface the wealth of scientific collecting achieved and its continued influence on the way we think about our own natural world. So if science was a camouflage for conquest, as Perron implied, it was perhaps the most elaborate camouflage of all time. And the last image, what was Baudin's scientific legacy? Well, he brought the scientific bounty home safely so that it could be housed in institutions that would protect it and share it. And this bounty includes the treasures of the art of science that you will find throughout the catalogue.
Well, look, I'd like to thank Jean, Lyndall and John on behalf of you all for what I think has been an absolutely outstanding discovery event in every sense. I mean, not only about...